So, good evening. Nice to be here in this capacity. This is the first Dharma talk I've done, so I hope you'll bear with me. They ask us in the first Dharma talk to speak from our experience of meditation, what brought us to the practice, what's helped and what hasn't helped along the way. Is that too loud? Is that volume okay? Okay. So as I was pondering giving this talk, I sort of rattled my brain and thought, well, what was it that brought me to meditation? What made it make sense when I first began hearing about it? And I think it relates to that question that probably you've all asked at one point in time. What's the meaning of life? And what's the purpose? Why am I here? And I won't pretend to try to answer that. Like you, I guess we're all trying to somewhat figure that out. But nonetheless, there was a notion that there must be more. Must be more than what life on a day-to-day basis offered. Not that it was bad. Things went fairly well for me growing up. Difficulties along the way. So when I first heard about meditation, it was when I first moved here in the early 70s, and I've never been a television watcher, but I was visiting my aunt in Santa Cruz and happened to turn on the television one evening before I went out to go dance places and stuff. And there was a program on PBS called Middle Class Meditation. And it's like, okay, well, I mean, I had no idea what meditation, I mean, I thought it was something that strange people in the Himalayas did, and that's about all I knew about meditation. But the person that was presenting was Betty Bathards, and it was a four-part series that she did at that time. And Betty is the founder of the Inner Light Foundation, which still operates in Novato. And several of us at IMC have began our practice back in those days with Betty. The technique that she taught was a period of concentration and then a period of mindfulness. So it rather nicely fit with what we have learned at IMC. Although that was just a total of 20 minutes. So 10 minutes of concentration on any one single object. And then 10 minutes of mindfulness. And so I heard Betty on PBS, and that next weekend she was speaking in San Jose, and I went to a lecture she gave there, and the things that she talked about were really really spoke to me. She talked about that the value of meditation is, or some of the values have to do with having a greater sense of centeredness, having a greater awareness of one's intuition. It's like turning up the volume on the intuition. And she indicated that a lot of people find that their life flows a little more smoothly when they're devoting time to quieting their mind and develop an inner practice. I thought it was interesting enough. I was waiting to go to school in Berkeley at that time, and working. I just moved here. I hadn't really even found a place to live. I was staying with my dad in Santa Rosa some of the time, and my aunt in Santa Cruz. And there was Betty had groups all over the Bay Area. I guess the organization still does. Betty died, from what I understand, about 5 years ago, but the organization lives on. And so there were, it was volunteer groups around the Bay Area, and they were essentially lay practitioners, if you were, teaching or leading the groups. And so I joined a group in Santa Rosa, and a few weeks later found a part-time job before I started school in Oakland, and moved there. And I called to find out if there was another group that I might join, because the commitment was or the plan was like 8 weeks of meditation, meeting with this group once, and they encouraged us to meditate every day, again for 20 minutes. So that was pretty doable. And one of the things that Betty talked about and that I found for myself, and perhaps you have too, if you've been meditating on a regular basis, is that there's a certain synergy or inertia that happens, and it's hard to see necessarily any immediate benefit from it. There weren't too many times that I have sat then or in subsequent years where I found it to be a mind-blowing, life-altering experience to some degree. But it was easier to see over, looking back in retrospect, over a period of about 3 months. And so that was very helpful. And one of the things I thought about as I was preparing for this talk is that a factor that fit in with helping me along the way in one way or another relates to the triple gem: the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. We didn't necessarily at that time use that terminology, but where particularly the Sangha, which is the community of like-minded people that have a common purpose. We're wanting to grow. We're wanting to understand ourselves on a deeper level. Wanting to relate to other people in a more compassionate, loving way. And I found that to be true. When I moved to Oakland, there wasn't a group. And I called Betty to ask about that, and she said, "Well, you can lead a group. I have a lot of people that have signed up and want to be in a group in Oakland." And I said, "Well, I've just started learning this myself. I've just been to 4 weeks of the sessions that they were teaching in Santa Rosa with the newcomers group." And she said, "That's okay. Come to my house in Novato, and I'll teach you. I'm doing a teacher training, and I have some, model that you can follow, and it teaches you what to teach." And essentially, the group teaches itself. And that was a rather precious thing for somebody to do. If she had the idea I could do it, I thought, well, okay. And 15 people that came to the first 8 sessions of the group, which was at my house in Oakland. And certainly the commitment to help to maintain the continuity of my daily practice. And there were several things, in my early life that made this, I'll kind of jump around a little bit, going back to some of the things that for my made it somewhat interesting to begin to pay attention to any of this stuff. And by the time I was a little kid, I noticed that my grandparents' house, things were in order. They flowed pretty smoothly. They seemed to have sort of what we might call a charmed life. I mean, they weren't terribly smart. They weren't terribly rich. They were comfortable. But at our house, I'm the oldest of 5 kids. You might imagine things were a little tumultuous, a little chaotic. My parents were divorced when I was about 7, and I was appointed the little father of the group, and took on the role rather wholeheartedly, as much as a 7-year-old can. But nonetheless, when my mother remarried, my stepfather was a interesting guy who, I'm not sure what would inspire him to take on a young woman with 4 children, little kids. But he did, but he was a rather moody guy. His mood swings, we never knew what to expect when he came home. And so I think that spilled over onto myself and my siblings in terms of anxiety. And when kids feel anxious, they act out. And so that brought a certain level of chaos to our house. And I wondered, why couldn't our house be as calm as my grandparents? You know, my grandfather had been a successful businessman. By then he'd retired, and I always had a hope that things could be better. So when I heard Betty speaking to this point, it spoke to some old feelings and thoughts that had been in the back of my mind for some time. By then I was in my mid-20s when I started meditating. And I think there were several things from my growing up years that really augmented the practice that we were learning. And in the group that I meditated with, we were all studying a bunch of different spiritual stuff. Hinduism, Buddhism, mystical Christianity. We were open-minded to everything. And that was a very supportive, important factor to the growing of our little sangha. But when I was growing up, I found meaning and value from a community. My stepfather became active in community activities, one of which was the Masonic Lodge, and he encouraged me as I was a teenager to join the DMLAs, which is a youth fraternity organization for boys. And they teach the higher values of life that have some parallel to the Eightfold Path, which is right speech, right livelihood, what were they? Reverence or respect of parents, courtesy, comradeship, fidelity, cleanness of mind and body, those kind of things, which, you know, it's sort of like, okay, well, that's a nice idea as a kid. It's just sort of like, seemed fine. But then when I could really, I didn't really think about that per se, but as I was preparing to talk tonight, I realized that, wow, that really nicely complemented the Eightfold Noble Path, and that the Triple Gem, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, rang in there too. The meditation group that I was in, I was the quasi-leader the first 8 weeks, and then the group wanted to continue. So we moved to another person's house that was in the group, and the group continued for years, many years. I was one of the youngest in the group. Other people were middle-aged, and some were elderly, and they had studied Rosicrucians and you name it. Very interesting group of people. From a very different walk of life, here I was a young college student. This couple's son that the group moved to their house was going to community college, but kind of just getting by academically and socially. He had some challenges, and then there were some middle-aged Berkeley hippies that were in the group, women that were, you know, sort of earth mother, you know, very different than I had been exposed to, and then this elderly couple that brought a wealth of, but the meditation, I think, brought a coming together of hearts and minds. As I said, we studied a bunch of different stuff, and we were all interested in what other people were studying, and so there was the Dharma there. We were talking about spirituality and growth and mysticism and why are we here and what can help that process of growth. And so that was a very valuable experience, and in fact the group continued in one way or another until Mac and Wilma were the middle-aged people died. Now I'm a little older than they were when they started the group there. So anyway, it was an interesting process, and I feel very grateful for the opportunity that afforded. So what else? My life was pretty peaceful in those days, so I wasn't married, I wasn't in a relationship, I was going to school, I worked part-time at Lincoln Child Center in Oakland, and it's a very passionate environment with kids that had significant emotional difficulties. And one of the things that happened then, and I realized before and subsequently, is that things seemed to fall in place for me in a certain way that I couldn't have orchestrated if I tried. That were real profound teachings and opportunities. And so I certainly wouldn't, you know, say that, you know, God came down and laid this gift on me. I didn't particularly know how to understand it, but I think it has to do with what probably all of us in this room have experienced, sort of the synchronicity of of having a goal and a focus and a purpose and a community of people that can help along the way. And so working at Lincoln was a profound and interesting opportunity and quite a growing experience, just in terms of love and compassion and seeing the pain in these children's lives, the things that they had been through at 8 years old that none of us would ever think of. It's hard to imagine, but anyway, they had somehow managed to get through that. And as I was going to school and working, some of the things that Betty talked about were quite useful in terms of keeping a balance mentally, physically, spiritually, emotionally. And so when I was feeling distraught, I would kind of do a self-inventory of, where am I physically? Okay, well, I'm getting some exercise, but not that much. Mentally, I'm studying a lot. Spiritually, I'm doing meditation and reading spiritual materials. Emotionally, certainly I'm learning a lot about my own inner life by working with these kids that would push all the buttons at once. Love, hate, you'd want to strangle them, you'd want to cry with them. It was quite moving, and it helped to open up my heart in lots of ways. And I'm thankful for that. So I continued meditating fairly much over since those early 70s. There was a period of about 5 years that I didn't meditate per se. It was early in my relationship with Cheryl. We kind of had different physical clocks, and so I was more interested in or able to meditate and quiet my mind at the end of the day. I'd kind of done everything that needed to be done or could be done at that time, so I was ready to sit. But Cheryl starts out in high gear, and so she's much more energized in the morning than I am. So ultimately, for one reason or another, we kind of got out of the habit of meditation, but nonetheless, I taught her, as I did my graduate school roommates, and they continued meditating and still do too once in a while, particularly David. So there was a time that I wasn't actively meditating, but still I realized that I was studying various spiritual things. Along the way, I'd run across A Course in Miracles. It's not the course. They point out it's a course. There's lots of paths. It utilizes Christian terminology, which is a bit of a put off, and people would ask, well, why is this used? And the response from the source was that this is language you understand, and so I teach in this language, and it's important for you to have a corrective experience in what these words really mean, and that what is taught in miracles is different than what at least I learned in from a Christian kind of background. My family went to church at various times, but I can't say that church was a particularly that I really understood what they were talking about. But what I did understand was the love of the community and the group and the kids when I was a child, and some of those terms that I had heard, and perhaps you had heard terms from Christianity, began to make sense in recent years with sitting in meditation. The kingdom is within. That's interesting. My father's house has many rooms, or something like that. However that goes. So it didn't make any sense then, and it wasn't negative. So some people have a lot of stuff to get over in terms of their religious background, and I'm thankful that mine was neutral at worst. And when my parents were going through a divorce, it was quite helpful to go to the crafts group and make potholders and sing these crazy songs. That when I heard the words Christian soldiers, now I think, what a strange thing, But I guess it speaks to some people. So there's certainly a group energy that comes about from that kind of a process. And so it gave me something that I was able to carry into the future. And so as time went on in the early 90s, I realized that though I was studying various things, I studied with the Self-Realization Fellowship Foundation, Paramahansa Yogananda's group in L.A. And that was one of the things that some of us in the early meditation group read, probably books that those of you who've been around a while with this kind of stuff, Ram Dass's book, Be Here Now. That was kind of a favorite classic, The Autobiography of a Yogi. Let's see what else, Carlos Castaneda's books and stuff like that. It's kind of like, wow, there's something maybe more to life and energy than I know about or can understand. But there were things that were inspirational. And the thing that was a blessing and a curse from those early teachings was that Ram Dass said that when the student's ready, the teacher will appear. Well, I think I took that quite literally. And I wasn't actively studying with the teacher per se. It would have served me well if I had met with Betty or pursued a meditation community like this at that time. But I didn't, and I thought, you know, after 5 years or 10 years, that, you know, enlightenment would drop in my lap somehow, or drop into my mind, and I would have some mystical experience. And that is a little bit more what the Hindu traditions teach, and perhaps people do have some moments, temporary or lasting, of cosmic consciousness. And what's seemed more relevant in recent years, from what I've learned from the Vipassana tradition, is that enlightenment is moment by moment. We're tuned in and mellow and relaxed and peaceful or not, in that to some degree it's a choice. And there's a synergy that comes from practice. And I think some of the other meditation stuff that I'd done in the past when I began studying and sitting in a Vipassana tradition was quite helpful and brought some experiences that were quite profound and absorbing, and the concentration with an absorption of really a deep focus. I found somewhat in my very early years of practice, what was quite useful in my early meditation was that, as I mentioned, I didn't watch television at that time. To have it on in Santa Cruz when I was visiting my aunt was like quite a coincidence, but mostly I haven't even owned a television. But at night before I'd meditate, I would read. I would, and the various things that I was reading was very, very inspiring. And there was a certain darshan or energy that came through from the authors that really brought my mind to a very peaceful state that was a nice preparation for sitting. And I found that to be quite useful. And when I do it on a regular basis now, it helps my practice. But a lot of times I sit down after a busy day and try to quiet or focus my mind. And I can to some degree, but I think it's a lot more beneficial when I carve out time for 15 or 20 minutes of just reading some text that's inspiring. I remember some of the early books that I read. I'd be sitting in the yard and I would have goosebumps all down my arm. It's like it was just being struck with, wow, there's some profound truth here, and wishing to know more about it. And so I first got introduced to Vipassana through Cheryl, actually, although I was more the one that was interested in meditation, but she was seeing a therapist at Kaiser that recommended their mindfulness-based stress reduction class, which is essentially Vipassana. They utilize a text and guidance of lessons from Jon Kabat-Zinn from the University of Massachusetts Medical Center. I see some people nodding, so maybe a few people besides us came here through that. And the first class that I went to was here in Redwood City, and we sat for 45 minutes, and I thought I would jump out of my skin. It's like, oh my God. I mean, I had gotten kind of lazy about meditation at that point, so I hadn't been sitting for 20 minutes, much less 45, and I'd sat for a few times for 45 minutes, but it was really a challenge. But keeping with the agreement of doing some meditation and a little bit of yoga using the tapes that they gave was quite helpful. And then I, after the class was over, we found out about Gil teaching in various places, the friend's house, in mini house in Palo Alto. So we went there and gradually, and then I decided, well, maybe I need to go to this one of these day-long things. So my entry into meditation from this tradition was kind of a slow movement. And so I went to some of the day-long retreats and started regularly going to that, and that was really hard. I mean, it was very difficult for me. But I got through it somehow. And after a year or so, hearing about the longer retreats, I went to the Memorial Day retreat that Gil does every year up at Jokoji. And that was another really difficult experience. And I remember being, if it was that year or another one, but I remember being really irritable and impatient. It's like, why am I doing this? I feel all this physical pain and this hurts and I don't know why I'm doing this and it's such a waste of time and yada, yada, yada. And I was just really in an annoyed state, to say the least. And when I left there and went home, I had a message from somebody who needed somebody that I'd been working with that had one of the most profoundly difficult experiences that I've worked with over the years and that none of us would want to go through. And hearing the pain that he was describing that went on for weeks and months really helped me to put my petty little BS in place. And yet I could see that the pain of being present, even to the little degree that I was with my pain, helped me to be present with this guy and put in perspective the gripes and annoyances that I had, but also see the benefit. It's like working out. You know, if you need to run up the stairs or down the stairs to get out of a fire and you've been exercising, we're able to do it with a lot more safety and confidence if we've been exercising. So the meditation was kind of like an exercise for the spirit or the mind. And I found that again most profoundly a year or so later when my father was dying. He wasn't somebody that was interested in spirituality or any of this kind of stuff at all. In fact, held it, organized religion anyway, in rather obvious disdain. He knew that I'd gone to some meditation stuff. But when he was on his deathbed, he was on his deathbed. He was in the hospital in Palm Springs and was admitted. Cheryl and I went down for Thanksgiving in 99. And when we got there, there was a note, come to the hospital. And so he went over and so he had a bladder cancer. And he stayed in the hospital until he died about a month later. So I tried to be present as best I could. And for the most part, I was. And really could see what was happening. Cheryl had worked in hospice at that time. And so I knew a little bit about hospice. And her father had died. And we kind of had a sense. When I was in graduate school, I had a course on utilizing Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's book on death and dying. And so I had a sense, particularly from my spiritual practice, that I wasn't uncomfortable with death. And I felt as best I could be complete with my dad. So some of my other family members weren't. They had a great deal of difficulty. My dad's sister, my aunt from Santa Cruz, wasn't ready. Neither was my youngest sister to let him go. And I remember once my aunt was there, again in Palm Springs, and I was there, and they brought lunch, and she was trying to get him to eat, you know, and she was sort of almost force-feeding him, and to please her, you know, he would eat the soup or whatever it was, you know, but I could see he really wasn't into that. And at a certain point she said, "Oh, you go ahead and feed him. I need to go to the restroom or something." And so as soon as she went out of the room, I said, "You don't want this, do you?" He said, "No." And so I could see where he was, and he could see that I could see. And I was accepting that if he wanted something later, you know, I'd certainly give it to him. They had different stuff that he could eat there. But I think it helped him to let go, and it helped me to have a sense of, okay, I can see what's going on here. I can see the pain of my aunt. I can see my dad's fear. He had a durable power of attorney for health care and that kind of stuff that said, don't give me anything. Don't give me any valiant means. Don't do anything to extend my life. And if you think about it, don't. So it was one of the most emphatic ones that some... Well, actually, the spiritual director at the hospice where Cheryl worked, I talked with him. He said, I've never heard one that emphatic. And so at one certain point, the doctor was kind of giving him false hope. I talked to him, the doctor, and he, you know, didn't seem to want to take any other course, although we had heard clearly from my father's doctor in Sacramento when he first had this issue, that when you have two or three organ systems failing, that it's not too far away. And I found out later that this younger doctor in Palm Springs, his father was dying on the floor below my dad, so he wasn't ready, and his father is a younger man. So you certainly wouldn't want a doctor that's all doom and gloom and ready to pull the plug. So, you know, I was grateful, and I think my dad was, that that this guy was trying to do what he could do to extend his life. And when I faxed him a copy of my dad's wishes, the power attorney, he met with the ethics committee and realized, yeah, it's okay to let go. So my father got hospice, and he moved to the wing of the hospital that was residential. And the previous year, I'd been to the meditation, the New Year's retreat that Gil does at Spirit Rock, which is a wonderful way to ring in the new year. It's six, seven days, whatever. And I had one of the red protection cords on, and periodically it would kind of fall out of my t-shirt or something. One of the nurses there saw that and said, "Oh, you got a protection cord, huh?" And I was just kind of surprised, because nobody had ever commented or, you know, knew what it was or anything. So there was a sense of a process happening. And my father had been in a coma the weekend before he died. When he came out of the coma, he seemed to have an altered state of awareness, of peacefulness that was quite interesting. It was a huge change for him. Not that he got saved or anything like that, but, you know, he asked me, "So what is this meditation thing that you do?" And I said, "I know, I've tried to explain it to you before, haven't I? And I don't think I've done a very good job of explaining it." And so I was remembering to the previous Christmas, New Year's retreat with Gil, there were times that I had rather long periods of concentration and quite a sense of peacefulness and a spaciousness and a kind of a letting go. And so I was kind of describing that happens sometimes, not necessarily all the time, but I was kind of grasping for a word at a certain point of, you know, what it was, spaciousness or something, and he tossed out the word, and I knew that he got where I was coming from. And one of the things that I commented was that when I felt a really peaceful, centered state of mind, there's a clear sense of, this is not me, I'm not this body. There's another sense of presence or consciousness that can be there. And it's not something that I experience all that often when I'm sitting, mostly I don't. But I find it to be more accessible when I go on longer retreats. So I would encourage any of you that haven't done that to give some thought to doing that. Gil's a wonderful teacher, and all the teachers at Spirit Rock I think are great. I think it's one of the major things that has helped to move my practice forward in a more significant way in recent years. And I try to do that shorter retreat, the Memorial Day retreat, or one of the longer ones, just 6 or 8 or 10 days, something like that, once a year. I think certainly sitting with the group, and as I did in the early years, once a week, I felt like I got my batteries charged. So even if a longer retreat doesn't at all even work for you and entertain it, it's okay. Coming here, I think that it's like I felt a certain revitalizing of my meditative, spiritual energy, whatever, when I meditated with my little group in Oakland. And it helped me to, through the next week, to sit on a regular basis and feel a different level of energy or presence there. So, let's see. So I mentioned that the triple gem seemed to play itself out. Certainly the Buddha, I don't think of myself as a Buddhist per se. You know, that's not what's going out to the world here. Sacrilegious to say in this environment, but I think that it's not uncommon that people think, well, I think of it more of as a philosophy than a religion. It's a religion because we're tax, deductible and whatever, non-profit. So, but it just seems like a common sense kind of philosophy or teaching. And it fits nicely with one of the things that Betty said early in my study with her. One of the comments that she made is, if I say something here that doesn't make sense to you, toss it out the window. If it's a truth, it'll come back to you at a time you can use it. So that really helped me to be more open-minded about looking at stuff that seemed a little weird or esoteric or mystical or whatever. But that's the same thing, isn't it, that the Buddha said. I don't believe what I say or somebody else says. Try it yourself and see how it works. If it works, fine. If it doesn't, do what works. Just pay attention. And that's where the insight part is. I was looking through Jack Kornfield's book last night as I was thinking about things that I wanted to talk about, A Path with Heart. And he talked about some of the sort of altered states of consciousness that can occur sometimes. And he talked about how that can be a real obstacle in the path to growth. That if people are looking for that, it's there for some people. Some people have it and some don't. It's almost irrelevant whether they do or not, because if no matter what kind of light shows or mystical sounds or whatever that you might hear, without insight and without really looking at what are my thoughts, what's happening now in my world, right now, in this body, in this world, what are my thoughts about what's happening and what are my emotions? Unless I have some connection with that, I could sit blissed out, in a cave for years. And Jack talks about that quite articulately in that book, The Path with Heart. Talks about coming back from Asia for a year of meditation, very intense, and walking into I think it was Elizabeth Arden's salon in Washington or New York to pick up his mom, and just feeling totally nuts. And he said all of these wonderful mystical experiences of whatever, were worth a you know, a quarter in that, and you get a phone call. You can make a phone call in those days for a quarter or a dime, but he's, you know, it didn't serve him. And so he realized, as I did, that doing counseling helps to augment that process. And both Cheryl and I have spent time individually and as a couple, and I think that's helped my growth process over the years to understand myself as much as I can. And certainly the quietness and the vipassana, the insight of looking more deeply, has been quite helpful. And not just the mindfulness, but who was that recent teacher that was here? Pardon?
Steve Armstrong?
No. Utanjaniya. Yeah, Steve talked about that too, because he had studied with Utanjaniya, hasn't he? He talks about not just noticing what's happening. Okay, here's a thought of lust or greed or aversion or whatever, or physiologically, ache, pain, stab, whatever. But to look at the broader state of mind behind that. And so I've been trying to do that more, because I don't know that I'd necessarily... It's probably been said 100 times, but I didn't get it. So I'm trying to do that a little bit more. And that seems... That seems to be helpful. It gives me a little extra grist for the mill. So I hope this has been useful to you. And as I said, as Betty said to me, if it's not, set it aside. It'll come back if it's relevant. Take what works and leave the rest behind is another way of putting it. They ask us to leave time for comments or questions or discussion, and so let me ask if any of you have any questions or comments that you'd like to make. Or did I leave anything out? Because I said to Cheryl, I'll probably forget some things that we've talked about that I wanted to include, so anyway.
If you do have any questions, let's use the mic for the sake of the recording.
I'm curious to know how you incorporate your experience with mindfulness or mindfulness itself in your work.
Yeah, that's a good question. What I try to do when I'm in my office is... and also other times in life, is just try to quiet my mind of trying to figure out what's going on or figure out what I should do or somebody else should do, and try to be as present as I can with my body. Gil talks a lot about that, and that's been quite helpful to me, and I would be wise to do it more, because that's not something that comes immediately, even after all these years of meditating. I find that a nice complement to Vipassana is the treatment of choice now for a lot of different issues, which is called cognitive behavioral therapy. And the way that works is looking at what is an upsetting issue that's happening now in life today. And what are the emotions that I experience as I think about this person cutting me off in traffic or someone being rude in a store, whatever it might be? What are my emotions? Sad, angry, scared, embarrassed. And what are my thoughts that perpetuate those feelings? And looking at, do those thoughts make any sense? If this person doesn't understand what I'm saying, does that mean I'm stupid? Does it mean they're stupid? No. It just means that they didn't understand. And so I think that on a practical working basis, I think that it is a nice complement, cognitive behavioral therapy. And this book by David Burns called The Feeling Good Handbook, which is a workbook that teaches this particular approach, is one of those things that's simple but not easy. But I think as much as anything, it's trying to be present and to hear and feel and get what somebody's saying and to try to check with them to see if I'm getting it, because I might or might not. But it gives a sense of synergy, of two minds being joined together when two are gathered. There's a certain synergy that goes with that. And I do encourage people. I find that if somebody that I'm working with has a spiritual practice of some kind, any kind, doesn't matter. I mean, I guess not any kind, but it helps. There's a certain synergy or presence that seems to inform and guide the process. So I encourage people to take the class at Kaiser or Peninsula Hospital or wherever that teaches the mindfulness, because it doesn't have any particular religious overtones to it, and or to come here or different stuff. So thanks. Yeah, she was asking if I could benefit from taking the mindfulness-based stress reduction class now. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm not sure that it's as crucial, given that I've been coming here for a long time. But I think anybody could benefit from it. It's probably a better introduction for somebody who's never done any kind of body work, because I do some yoga, so that's useful. Terry does that here, of course. Wonderful teacher, and they utilize a tape. It's kind of a guided imagery sort of tape, and so I think it's.
Now that I have the mic, I can't think of the other thing that was so important. I really benefited from your talk. I feel like, you know, all those things they're paralleled what you did. And it's so nice after all these years of seeing you here to know all that happened for you. Oh, actually, I do have the other question. Right now, just this week, it seems I have a lot of old friends that want to get together. And they're dear friends that I've known for years, but they don't have a spiritual practice. This is rather hard for me. Would that ever be hard for you now?
What about it's hard for you?
Well, it seems like what's most important for me at my age and such and what I'm doing is not something that they maybe quite even understand. And, you know, I just feel resistant.
Hmm.
I have a lot to do in my life, and so then my other time, more like leisure time, it's just hard for me to spend a lot of time. I can think of four people right now that call, let's get together, you know. And I feel like I'm a bad person because I'm thinking, okay, well, just for a little bit, I'm thinking. Mm-hmm. Does that ever happen to you? Or?
It does. It does sometimes. One of my college roommates, I experienced that with. He's just at a very... His priorities in life are just very different than mine. And I just find myself uncomfortable when I'm around him, and I had to be more honest about what I was feeling in recent years when I saw him. And so, just for old time's sake, I might spend limited amount of time with him. another roommate that I had when I first moved to Berkeley is an old soul. She's really the one that encouraged me to move into this field, and has some significant mental illness issues. She's manic depressive, so she gets very intense and quite and out of balance sometimes. So I can spend some time with her and help to learn and enjoy her energy. But I have to kind of to have some boundaries there so that I don't get too caught up in some of the drama that she seems to keep in her life, and people that help her with that process. But then, on the other hand, I have had another friend who died in recent years. But he kind of like my dad. He had some disdain for spirituality, but yet a curiosity, especially as he got closer to dying. He had idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, and so it was kind of like emphysema, ultimately not being able to breathe. So although he didn't have any interest in religious or spiritual stuff, he was a profound teacher, an eye for him. And he would often ask, so is there, what do you think, is there life, is there reincarnation, is there life after death? And I said, I don't know. Our teacher doesn't talk about it, you know, because he knew that I was interested in it. But he tried to talk about Buddhism and things that people are interested in. So he would always ask that question. And it's something that if you and I were speaking, I could, you know, talk to or think about her and talk about on more. I just said that I'm not sure that the teacher that I study with says he's an agnostic in terms of reincarnation. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Who knows? It's conjecture. But I think that what Dave was looking for was some sense of, will I be okay when I die? Or will I be okay, can I have some hope between now and then? And because of his love and because of his wisdom, because of the experience that I'd had with my father in hospice, and my mom as well had hospice, and she had emphysema, and so it was a similar disease to Dave's. I was able to, I almost had to put him in a full Nelson to pin him down to the rug to get him to accept the hospice. But when he did, it was a relief and a letting go. And so I think that it was very easy to be around him because there was a consideration, a caring, and an extreme generosity. He was a single man, but I couldn't talk to him on the phone for an hour, but what there'd be at least three interruptions with somebody coming to the door, to the front gate, another phone call or something. I mean, he had a lot of friends. He was very generous. He gave a little bit of money to a lot of his friends and, you know, wanted to do it while he was alive. You know, and it was just, and people were interested in him because he was interested in them. So that was there was a spirituality that was, it's kind of like, you know, the old saying, when I was a Buddhist, I drove everybody nuts, but now that I'm Buddha, we're all at harmony or something, however that goes, something like that. And so I think that Dave was kind of like that. He had a spirituality, but not a religious part to it. So I try to, if I'm totally uncomfortable with being with somebody, then I try to understand what that is, of course. When I find that I'm no longer able to be patient or compassionate or whatever, as I said with my one friend, I have to slowly, you know, back out and say, I'll talk to you later and keep boundaries. So part of it's, does it work? Okay, well, I see it's about 9 o'clock, so why don't we sit for just a minute before we stop. So, thank you. If I've said anything that's been unkind or hurtful, I ask for your forgiveness.